My wife and I will be leaving tomorrow morning to take the plane to the Lake of the Ozarks. Since this will be the last time I will address you, I wanted to choose a topic that will cover the fundamental areas in life that affect all of us, young or old, that pertain to child rearing. And I would like to address it from the point of view of the missing dimension in child rearing in the Church of God. Because if we were to look back at the history of our responsibility in this area, we would discover that there is a fundamental missing element that has allowed no small problem, especially in some of the larger metropolitan areas, that needn't have happened. We have emphasized discipline. We have emphasized the need to properly thank and instruct youngsters to say no when no should be said. But there is an area that perhaps Paul didn't fully address. And I quote a verse that he wrote, because Paul himself was not a parent, was not married as far as we know, and he wrote it much as we wrote up the subject before we learned, in many cases, what it takes to live it. He said, Ephesians 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. The law says, honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise. Quote, continuing from the commandment, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Now, the important point, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline, we've emphasized that, and instruction of the Lord. Now, this is quite all right for your responsibility as a parent. When you look at the child, you bring the children up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. But Paul did not address the question of what the child sees in the parent, but what the parent is to be aware of when coming to the question of responsibility toward the children. And what we have failed for years fully to comprehend is what the child sees in the parent, which we call his example. It is one thing to discipline a child, but do you discipline yourself? It's another thing to instruct a child. It's another thing also to know whether you are following God's instruction in your own life as father and mother. We had in this church responsible teaching in general in the matter of discipline and instruction. We had a significant failure when it came to the matter of parental example. And this is the area that I would like to address as the focus for this afternoon. There are different terms we might use in the matter of child rearing. In speaking of it in one of the churches in Illinois, I addressed it in the following manner. I said, the successful parent, whether he knows it or not, is adopting a method of total awareness in child rearing if he is proving or if she is proving as a mother to be successful. You've all heard of Art Linkletter, a very competent and able person, on radio and TV especially, who had a daughter who died from drug overdose. Because, though he might have been a good disciplinarian, might have given proper instruction, he was not totally aware of what was occurring. Because there was something missing in the role as parent, and a great man as he is in this world, he came to grips with it and has conveyed to others that particular aspect which he overlooked. The ability to let his example play an intimate role in his daughter's life. He was in another world. He was in the world of entertainment. She was in her own world. If we are going to marry and have children, we have to decide whether that's the route to go or whether we are career-oriented, whether we should be a part of the me generation. It used to be called the now generation, and the new one is me, because it forgets you. U.S. News and World Report had a very good article on that that prompted a great deal of valid response. What we need to do is realize that the question of child rearing does not begin when the baby is 1 year old or is born. It doesn't even begin at marriage. It begins well before then. Maybe we don't reflect on this, but it is a fundamental factor over which you have a control. I'm not talking about your parents, over which you had no control, or maybe you did and that was your undoing. But assuming that now we are dealing with your responsibility as a young man or a young woman, the ultimate decision of success or failure in child rearing is made by the choice of the mate you marry. I doubt that most young people give serious thought to the nature of the kind of husband or the kind of wife they are choosing when it comes to thinking about rearing of children. We often date and make choices on the basis of our interest, our desire, the temporary moment. We do not seriously reflect in the long range as to what effect a woman's husband will have on her children, a man's wife will have on his. We probably, of all areas, overlook most the character of the relatives and their in-laws of your prospective mate. I learned long ago from an experience, without ever having given a thought to it in advance, but I followed Mr. Rice's teaching before I heard it, I reflected on what I learned. It was in the baptizing tour in 1953 that I shared with Mr. Roderick Meredith first, and then later Mr. Norman Smith, that I had a chance to visit the relatives of my wife in northern Texas. It was one of those unusual opportunities to see the relatives and their relatives, or their in-laws. And I learned a great deal about the character of her family, and interestingly, the character of the people they chose to marry. In other words, not merely discovering who's the girl's brother or the sister, or who's the fellow's brother or sister, hoping you don't get too close to father or mother. I'm talking about finding what the uncles and the aunts are like and whom they marry and what success they have, because it gives you an idea of the state of mind of the family into which you marry. I discovered, interestingly enough, that some of the in-laws in my wife's family were even more the kind of people I grew up with than some of her immediate family. That is, I found that they identify in marriage with many of the people in the community I grew up with, which tells you a great deal about the probable success. When we have great differences of education, differences in class background and rearing, when we have, of course, differences in religion, these are all problems. We don't deal with the matter of religion other than with the mate, but you may have to live with the reality that there can be serious problems even within the extended family, and we should try to avoid that where possible. After all, many of you come from families where your immediate relatives, fathers or mothers or otherwise, or brothers or sisters, for those of you who are older, are not in the church. And we always try to bear in mind not to create problems in that area. A family is happiest when it can share a great deal. So I would like to suggest as a beginning, for those of you who are already married, that you give some time to reflect on whether the mate you have is one that you chose from this point of view. Now, maybe it worked out very well in your case. But I think you need seriously to realize to what extent a successful husband or wife goes a long way in making for the success of children. Any man knows that if he's away at work, not on the farm, but in the city, in a factory, that inevitably the state of affairs of his children up to year 5 and after they get home from school for years thereafter is dependent significantly on the mother. But today, of course, in the world, it is dependent significantly on the babysitter. But that is one of the great tragedies. We have children molded after the example of babysitters rather than either fathers or mothers. And we are copying, of course, much of what occurs behind the Iron Curtain and doing it in the name of society. And I do not think that it is a good policy. I had lunch with a family with a young man and his sister. He's interested in a young lady in another state in the church. I didn't discuss anything at length in this area, but it prompted me to think of this topic as perhaps the most fundamental pertaining to the world today and the world tomorrow. He has to think of what it means to choose a person, what kind of woman she will turn out to be. What does her family stand for? Are her brothers and sisters on drugs? Are uncles and aunts alcoholics? Has divorce and remarriage been rampant in the family? Happily, in our extended family, this has never been a fundamental problem. But after you have made such a choice, and it would pay to listen to the advice of your father or your mother or guardian with respect to such a mate, I think we need to realize it's important to ask, let's say, the permission of a girl's father. This is one of the passing things. I was pleased that our oldest girl, who was married this past Sunday, married a man significantly her senior. He's 37 years old. He asked me for permission. This tells me something of his character. He explained his background, what he could do for her. This is an area where too often young people, even in the church, go contrary to their parents' advice. Not perhaps the majority, but a significant number of problems have arisen because the minority have failed to realize to what extent parental advice is helpful. Once you have established that there is a family connection that you wouldn't mind making, then you need to ask yourself, what is going to be your financial outlook? What do you propose to do, not only as a husband, in this case, to provide for your wife, which is a part of our marriage contract or covenant, but what do you propose to do financially for the care of your children as they mature? One of the tragedies in society is that the people who are most able financially to take care of their children have the fewest number of children when it comes to making choices. Now, there are some who are barren, and that's not a matter of choice. But very often, those who are least able tend to have the most. We have a great visiting dignitary in this land who does not have any understanding of the question of planning for children and financially providing. He should like the land of physical blessing, where we do have responsible parenting, to provide for hundreds of millions of mouths where parents are taught not to be responsible when it comes to bring children into the world. That is one of the grave mistakes of the institution he represents. It's one of the problems all over the world. Now, we cannot always foresee the future, but we at least should have what we call a game plan. If you propose to have children, you should analyze what it is that you would like to be able to provide for them besides the question of education at Ambassador College. You should like to know what it is that you can do to establish, if you have sons, them in a financial responsibility to be able to successfully be married in the next generation. We have, and are going to have a message on Ambassador College. Now, one of the things, of course, we're learning in 1979 and 1980 is that financing a son or a daughter in the college is not like it was in 1949 and 1950. And so there is the need for long-range financial planning, not at the time your children are 17 and ready to enter college, then it's too late. You need to think of it before the children arrive. Then you will be planning and have time to make decisions so that financially they will be able to succeed in what they are doing, where their talents lie. All this is a matter of background, and if you learn to be responsible in this way, having chosen a responsible mate, having made responsible decisions financially, in terms of your long-range goals, then you will be prepared to be the example that your children will recognize as a proper example when it comes to making decisions when they are in their later teens. Now, after you have given thought to this area, then it comes to the question of health, probably the next most significant physical thing. You should be aware of your own state of health and the state of your mate, and that, of course, leads to the question of that every man normally thinks about, what kind of cook is your wife to be? And the answer, of course, is that some have much to learn. Others are good examples. One of the most delightful things I find in visiting a home is to go into the kitchen. I can remember an interesting story. Most of you would not know, but for those in Southern California, you will remember I brought to your attention the tragedy of the death of a woman in the Jewish community whom my wife and I have known for years. Mrs. Coatson was shot in her home with her son and a young guest by a masked robber, or a masked man. We know not really what his motive was. We don't even know who. We know nothing about it yet. I was in her home with my wife. Her husband was in the kitchen. The children at the time were upstairs. She said something which I've repeated several times, and I want to do it at this point because I think it will be of help in setting an understanding of the woman's role. When her husband is away, she said, my time is mine. But when he's home, my time is his. And she realized to what extent it was very important for her to be a responsible wife and mother. And it started with respect to the children in the kitchen. When we come to help, the husband was there helping. He would talk with her. He did some things in the preparation of the food. My wife normally tells me to do other things at the table. But that's because, different backgrounds and training require perhaps a different level of responsibility. Maybe a successful man is one who never bothers to set foot in the kitchen, but I happen to enjoy it myself. Here was a woman who was concerned about the health of her children and what would please her husband and her children. Much of the social time we have together, apart from Sabbath services, which are not a true social sense, it is something at a higher plane, but within the family unit, centers properly at the dining table, either in the kitchen or the dining room. Now, I'm sorry to say that for many families, it centers before the TV, but this is not what I am advocating. What we need to learn is that in child rearing, we set an example by what we do at the table, what we present to children at the table from the time they are infants. What a woman learns to cook, how she thinks to prepare, to make things both pleasant in appearance, good in nutrition, and yet not to be a matter of health food fanaticism. We solve this problem in any number of ways. It is good to take the children shopping as early as possible in a grocery store so they can see how you get it, how you prepare it. And you can explain, of course, that it all is ultimately a matter of divine creation. Then it is interesting to see how it is done in the kitchen. Very often children will say to mother, "Let me do that." Now, it isn't always the time when the husband's boss is coming to let the children do it. But there are plenty of times when children grow up, especially in the mornings when a wife prepares lunch, the husband isn't there, and it really doesn't matter too much how it turns out the first time or the second or the third or the fourth. But the point is, children do like to know when they're little. And that's usually the time when mothers don't want to be troubled. And later on, when other interests arise, then mothers would like their children to know. And then it's sometimes a little late. So it's helpful to learn to shop together as a family as time permits, and to let children see how you buy food. And they learn sooner or later that things are in season, that you financially make decisions best when you buy things in season. These are the things they learn by example. It's not something you can tell in some lecture. Then at the home, maybe you live in apartments, but even in an apartment it's possible to solve this matter. I think it is very helpful for children to see plants grow and to help plant in the garden, to have, if possible, a fruit tree or fruit trees, to have vegetables of various sorts, something that will properly grow in your area. Now, we have had also, in our case, the experience to have the children have goats. I don't recommend that for everybody. But as it turns out, we happen to be the babysitters for a goat farm in our neighborhood. Our son learned enough about it that he volunteered to take care of it recently. It was an experience that he learned when he was little. Now, we have our youngest girl who is 15, and she plants in the garden black-eyed peas and okra and various varieties of corn and squash and beans of other sorts. It doesn't take more than one or two plants. We're not here trying to say that you should raise vegetables. That's not my point at all. I'm saying that you can encourage children to see how these things grow that God made, so they become oriented to the creation. You know, when you avoid the problem of all the artificial containers and you get to the nature of how a plant grows and that it has its own natural, like the orange, its natural wraparound, we don't have to do what some modern people do, and that's take the egg out of its shell and put it in a plastic so you can see what's happening to it when you put it in hot water. But that's done in the big city. We had students at Ambassador College in Big Sandy who didn't know butter came from cream until his senior year of college. This is a tragedy. What we're saying, in another sense, is that children can learn responsibility. They can learn to associate good food with how God made it, how mother prepares it. There are no TV dinners in our home, have not been, shall not be. I think that our children have an appreciation. We had a daughter, the first one who married, who really didn't care for plants. And suddenly, when she got married, she became interested. Now, happily, she was the kind who always asked advice. So that we went over to her home, we spaded up the garden, she put in the plants, and raised better tomatoes than we do. Happens to be better soil. But if my wife wants to live on a hillside, that's her decision. It's not tomato country. The point is that our children did see it. We didn't force it on them. We encouraged them to do what they could do and enjoy with us. Some participated more than others. All of our children have appreciated their contacts with animal husbandry. They have appreciated, to some extent, gardening, and the example was sufficient that the one who didn't participate significantly before has become a good gardener. She remembers the example, and now we offer help at a stage when she enjoys our responsibility along with hers to make a success for her husband. We often do that on a Sunday morning when it's possible. Then, in cooking in the home as little children, one of the big problems that goes along with our misunderstanding of the real significance of discipline is that we often tell children, you've got to eat everything on that plate, when you made the decision as to the quantity, whereas the child had nothing to say about the quantity and may not have been hungry. Or, you've got to eat that spinach before you can get this ice cream. I see some of you grew up that way. Now, the way to have turned it around was the other way. You can have this ice cream, but the spinach, you know, is something that if you learn how to do, children will like it. I think it is a tragedy that often the good things that children were forced to eat, so that afterward, the stuff that was not really so good, the way ice cream is usually prepared in the marketplace, that was their reward for forcing down what was really good for them, which is not a way to set an example. Different people have different tastes. We never did have to adopt the policy of forcing our children to eat anything. That is, they saw that within God's law, we ate everything. There wasn't anything we objected to. I do object to vegetarian food where nuts are made to taste like meat. If I would like to eat nuts, I will eat nuts. And I think that was something we didn't allow in our home after one bad recipe. Now, you'll notice that my emphasis here has to do with this kind of participatory example. My wife happens to be an improving cook. She is improving every year. She was a good cook to start with and has consistently gotten better. She experimented with some recipes out of health food books in the early days of our marriage that were tragedies. The recipes were the tragedy. But we talk these things over. And if a recipe is good, I ask why. My wife used to say, well, she followed the recipe. Now she says, well, she improved on it. And you learn this. And the children learn by our discussion. These are some of the things we talk about. I think that the health of children is heavily dependent on a positive attitude they have. We have never told them how many lettuce leaves they must eat as distinct from slices of bread. We've never had that approach. We have been blessed in Southern California with being able to buy whole grains. We can grind them ourselves. My wife needs the dough. She also needs the other kind of dough, but that I work for. In this case, she really sets an example, and the children are delighted every time the loaves of bread come out of the oven. The children help to grind the flour. They're now also helping to knead the bread. Our married daughter asked to learn how to do it because her husband, fine, she's not baptized yet, she married, she's only 20, and her husband is not a member, but I will tell you a little bit about what kind of a son-in-law to choose. He likes good bread, and she's learning to do these things. She remembers the example. She didn't participate in it. We didn't force it in her case, and she was more interested in art. But she recalls the example and now wants to learn to do it. And so my wife explains on the phone how to do it. If a woman is a bad cook, it is little wonder that spinach is unpleasant. But when a woman is a good cook, I think one of the finest ways to eat spinach is in a salad, as distinct from some of the gruel that is served. Now, of course, little children can't participate in salads. That's just a bit later. But I think it's a mistake to assume that the first thing you must force down a child after the child is wishing to eat something other than drinking mother's milk is to force spinach when you don't know how to prepare it. But this is one of the mistakes. And I'm starting out here in an area that pertains to mental attitudes, if you can see what I'm saying. It pertains to good health. You know, we also wanted our children to learn something about the consumption of alcohol. So we made wine in two separate years. The children's favorite comment after we drank it was, "Daddy, why does your wine have to taste so homemade?" But that solves every possible problem of alcoholism. Had I devoted more time and skill and treated it as an art, it would have been better. But we simply did it in haste because we only had so much time and we had some of the finest vinegar in the lot. It was more potent than anything my wife could buy. But some of the wine was really very good rosé, as it turned out. I don't know why it bubbled, but it was good. You know, the children enjoyed working at it, watching how you make it. They enjoyed watching the little goats being born. They enjoyed taking care, as they do now, of our chickens, and we have our own eggs. It teaches them responsibility. I meet little children that do not know that birds drink water. You give them a bird and they would just simply let the bird die in the summer. They don't know this. It is astounding what I find. And I think all of this is important as I reflect back on it in a normal, healthy growth of mind and responsibility without making it seem to be dry and dull instruction. We didn't have to lecture the children to be responsible. They enjoyed seeing things grow and playing with the little creatures, and it was something they wanted to do for the creature. Now, this is a whole area of life that I have moved in from the point of view of health and nutrition, and you see how all of these things have an interplay in terms of rearing and responsibility. Making good financial decisions when you are buying food for the family. Now, as children grow up, we should start very early in terms of their social contact and give some serious thought to one area that, in most circumstances, you can have control over. We learned long ago that it was important when we moved from Pasadena to see that our children, when they had friends in school and were interested in those friends after school, to see that they brought those little friends to our home first before our children went to their home. Our youngest girl brought a friend home, and the first thing she wanted to do was talk. And the next thing she wanted to do was talk, and the last thing she was doing was talking. And our youngest girl was one who also wanted to study. This was the last time this child came over. It was also the first time. She just was one of those chattery young people that was socially not a responsible person. She brought another child home. Maybe it was interesting to talk with her in school. And all she wanted to do was eat. She came over once, and that was all. Our children made those decisions. We didn't. But they quickly learned, you see, when they had those children in our home, whether they fit our kind of upbringing. Because our children eat when necessary and study when necessary and talk when necessary, and we do what has to be done. We try to keep this balance, and when you have friends that are like this, fine, then you can enjoy their company. So it is important that we avoid the problem which has been so commonplace, and that is, let your children grow up in the neighbor's backyard instead of letting your children bring the neighbors over to see what they're like, to know what it's likely to be in their backyard. Our children in general have had a reputation in the neighborhood for being able to babysit. They babysit property, they babysit goats, of course, and they babysit children. And they've done this since they were comparatively young, because somehow the neighbors see that they are essentially responsible. It is very important that you know where your children are, to encourage them to tell you where they're going, if you know that there is a responsible place to go to. And we had to exercise discipline. I told my wife that if she allowed, again on one occasion, our son to go to a neighbor without telling us essentially when he's going to be back, he wouldn't be able to go. Sometimes there is a need of discipline. You have to explain what limits. Now, we've never set limits. We let the children set the limits, but we wanted to know what they were, and their judgment was basically good enough. It was never a problem. Now, if they varied from the limits, we expected an explanation. It brings to mind the fact that very many parents in the church, in my judgment, adopted in the area of discipline a great mistake. They assume that the only thing that a parent does after instruction is to say no, instead of opening up opportunities for the child to say yes, and for you as a parent to say yes. There is a time to say no. That's been explained over and over again. But one of the problems is that so often parents do not think of opportunities for their children in terms of their social or musical or educational or spiritual or sport areas. They let the children come up with the ideas, and then as parents you are often forced to say no to this because it wasn't the best idea. It is far more helpful to be able to anticipate by observation what the children like to do, or new opportunities they might enjoy they have not yet learned about, and offering several alternatives. We would ask our children, would you like to do this or that or something else over the weekend? Could we participate with them in some way and provide transportation? Or could we have children come over? Would they like to do things here? We offered suggestions before the children came up with many ideas, so they usually had to make one or two choices out of 8 or 10 hopefully good suggestions. And we never had to say no over and over again. Didn't I tell you you can't go over to the neighbor? Didn't I tell you you couldn't stay out? And you know, this kind of thing that you often hear. If you're positive and have this sense of what I call total awareness, that's the goal. It's never an absolute possibility in this life, but it's your goal. You can avoid so many of the negative problems in social contact. When it comes to music, we find that our children respond differently. My wife and I have our own musical tastes. You have yours. I personally recognize, I think Mr. Armstrong himself recognizes, that there are major differences in culture. He agreed with me one day when I said to him, we were discussing, you know, the difference between, let's say, his son's cultural taste in music and his. I mentioned that obviously in the auditorium we present great classical and other types of music. But one does not take a piano along when you go fishing. I don't. Any normal mind doesn't. You take, I don't think any of you ever have, you're all normal. You take a small musical instrument, something in keeping with the setting. In a sense, when you're fishing, to use that example, you're like the Bushman or you're like the pygmy in Africa. They create their own music for that occasion. They don't happen to have the occasion that we have here. But different settings allow for different musical senses to be expressed. Then we note that in our children there are also different bodily responses. Our second girl was one who logically responded to many of the modern forms of dance. For those of you who are not handicapped with vision, even to this day when she bids us goodbye, she's married, she does this. See, bye! She's just that kind of an individual. She's not formal. Now, our youngest girl plays the piano, and I think her music, essentially, is the opposite of anything that is modern. Those happen to be her tastes. We have played music. We are limited in our, let's say, musical repertoire, in contrast to many people. That is, we responded musically to the children's needs. We saw what their interests were or whether there were great musical needs. Now, two of our children are musically interested and talented. Two are not. Three are talented in art. And we tended to give them what it was that fulfilled them. In music, I have even given a whole sermon where this was a major factor. It wasn't the only one. But we have varied, of course, from the compositions of the Middle Ages to some of the modern music that we are familiar with in the United States today, to Fiji rock. Hope I offend nobody, but let me tell you this. I don't care for most rock in this country as it is done. I find that as it is done, for instance, with our background and experience in Fiji, it tends to fit. And of course, the words are quite different. It was a cultural form of music, not a subculture, which was the tragedy in this country. But we gave them opportunity to hear the music of Afghanistan, which they didn't appreciate. The music from Switzerland, from the Balkans, Spanish, Greek, Israeli music, music from the Middle Ages and modern times, marches and dances. They had sufficient to choose from and to sense. One of the records I used to play for guests was the Chinese composition, the Ode to the Yellow River, ordered directly from Peking. We always enjoyed the Red Army Band music Saturday night, in Finlandia Friday evening. There's a big difference. One is sabbatical music, and the other is a certain kind of post-Sabbath music. And it reflects the people. All this is a part of example. And in general, we encouraged our children, whatever their tastes would be, to make the best choice and to think of the effect, as Mr. Armstrong has said, of music on you and those around you. If it builds up, and I enjoy, especially my wife do, a strange kind of music. On a record we have, it is the bamboo chorus from the Solomon Islands. They have a musical instrument. It's a board that they slap against the end of different lengths of bamboo. You know, when you are in different areas of the world, your children learn what other people are like, and it broadens them. With respect to children who grow up in school, you soon discover talents, if you're observant, what they can do in school. And we've tried to be careful to encourage our children in the talents that they have. Now, some of us have more talents, some less. Some people are limited intellectually, but may be significantly endowed with talents. Some have the combination of both, and some have neither. And then there are the rest of us. But we have to work with whatever we are. I would say, I think in the church, we have underrated the talent of young people. I think we have never provided sufficient opportunities. I appreciate all that YOU has done. And I know that what the Dick family and the sons in that family have done, as well as many of the rest of you, in terms of sports activities. Our children never participated in YOU because in our school system, where we are, there was never a Friday night conflict. For whatever reason that happened to be, and so it was no problem for them. I know that our musical endeavors have really been worked on and improved, but I would still say I think one of the greatest shortfalls in the Church of God for a generation has been that we have never established our own musical culture. We have simply been influenced by the around. I admire what the Israelis did. Coming from many areas of the world, they created music that you recognize as Israeli. It was a sense of a people. And I believe that we have woefully neglected the capacity of younger and older people in the church to create our own music, in the sense that we set a standard of culture and diversity that nevertheless has themes that make you realize that this is music of the Church of God. Perhaps one of the greatest compositions, you know, that came out of the 1967 war was the work Jerusalem the Golden. It just was something that you, as an Israeli, you wanted to sing. I don't know whether that's ever going to be presented here. I don't know what the music, Mr. Dick. You might inquire of those who do. That's one of the most beautiful compositions just suddenly presented. You know, we have very few things that we can identify with in that sense as dance music in the church, as something that tells us what we want to do culturally as a people. Now, we've tried in that sense to encourage talent in our children, and you should in yours, and the church should locally wherever possible. We would go out of our way. Maybe it takes a little time. We enjoy doing it, making it possible for us to be there when our children's works were exhibited. We went to school when they made presentations in grammar school, junior high school, and high school, when they participated in art or drafting, to be there. It is very important that parents show, by example, their interest in the welfare of their children. You see, all of these things are a part of an area that was too often missing. Because we had instruction that tended to be rigid, we were referring too often to the width of belts, You know, we used to have rules about how wide your belt could be in imperial schools. We failed to realize, perhaps, that the children didn't hear when we said that it reflects an attitude when there was a belt change in the world and young people took the wide belt as a symbol of rebellion. The children thought the problem was with the belt, not the rebellion. And we got off often in many of these areas because we failed to take a look at what the real problem was. We wouldn't have had children trying to do something different consistently if there had not been somewhere along the line parental failure, either in discipline or in instruction, but primarily in example, in participating. And of course, TV has been the great destroyer of this participation. We would have TV, and then we allowed our children to have TV. We were years in getting it, of course. And we never bought one, except it came with a household of furniture once we bought from someone. And the children were enamored of it for a while. We have right now 3 TV sets in the house we've acquired, none of which are working for us. But they're busy at other things. When the president speaks, we'll listen on radio, and when I get around to it, I'll see that they get in working order again. But when the children looked at these programs, I would come in from work and I would stop by and look at the program. And the children sometimes would tell me about this interesting program they were watching. Then once in a while, there was no comment. And I had to ask, why are you looking at this program? It was obvious to me. Well, they couldn't find a reason. And it was very soon that I found that when I would ask them, when there was no justification for the program, why they were looking, they just simply went and turned the program off. And gradually it came to the place where they didn't turn it on. And when we knew there was a good program, we saw to it that it was on so that children would understand what a good program is. And we never allowed it to run, you know, half a day or a whole day's time. But that's a matter of being aware of what is occurring. Knowing how to keep children interested in so many other things that TV becomes incidental, but to use it effectively as a teacher for what it was intended to be. You will note in rearing of children that some will mature earlier, more readily than others. Our children are not here, and I'll tell a little story. Because they all know about it anyway. Our second girl married young and was already by age 15 aware of the kind of man she wanted. That is, she understood in her mind what characteristics a responsible husband would provide. As it turned out, her older sister introduced her to her older sister's haircutter, and that did it. But they knew each other for about 5 years, 4 and a half, from about age 15 to 19. Now, he was appreciably older, and he's the son-in-law I want to mention for the moment. They happened to be sharing many similar characteristics. And the most remarkable thing about those characteristics may be summarized in this, that the girl who married was a little young. We knew that. He knew that. She knew that. Now, when she didn't know certain things, he would call up and ask my wife, you know, to see that either she would explain it or what he should do to help. The one thing that he has always done is to ask us, me in particular, for advice when it comes to business decisions, or my wife for advice when it comes to those things pertaining to the home and responsibility in the home. I think it is a remarkable thing. We have never had to intrude. There's no mother-in-law problem. He comes to his mother-in-law, which is an indication, perhaps, of the wisdom of her choice. She had a 22-year-old mind when she was 15 when it comes to understanding men. Our 22-year-old daughter at the time, when it came to understanding men, had a 16-year-old mind. That is, she constantly had friends, but they were always people, young men, who needed some kind of maternal attention. And this was, in fact, characteristic of her because she was able to babysit from the time she was 2 3/4 years old. She was already taking care of her newborn sister. She has skills in dealing with people, but she couldn't identify the difference between a man who needed assistance that a mother should give and the relationship between a husband and a wife. The man she recently married is a man who discovered her, and this was the remarkable thing. Every other time she discovered the men. But in this case, it was the reverse. And it is, in my judgment, successful. She needed to have someone who saw in her what he needed. She is not now married to a man who needs her maternal attention. She's playing the role of a wife. We've had many mistakes in the church. Sometimes you were married before, but mistakes in which a husband or a wife marry the other person to reform the other individual in the hope that sooner or later he or she would turn out to be husband or wife. But marriage is not a reform school. Marriage is an institution between two maturing adults. And it should be at that point where we can accept each other for what we are, not to have to remake them. So it is important to know that children can be very mature in some ways in socially dealing with people. Our second girl that maturely understood her husband was an individual who was sort of a loner. She was not a leader. But the one who was not so clear in what to look for in a husband was always the leader of young people. And these are differences we have to work with to let the children recognize it in themselves and in each other and to capitalize on their strengths, not to try to remake them. To capitalize on their strengths to minimize the weaknesses. So this is very important in the conduct of any work as well as in child rearing. We've been cautious, but we've never had a problem in terms of dating. Our children have learned to judge carefully. We've learned to be socially responsible in the public schools. And I believe it's possible to say that if we continue to adopt this policy of example, that we also have not only the advantage of ourselves as parents, but if you have 2, 3, or 4 children, you will soon discover that you have the advantage of older children setting examples for younger ones. And here is where perhaps it pays off the most, that little children copy other little children or their older siblings, the older brother or sister, or brothers or sisters. And what parents must be aware of is that the older children set the kind of example that the younger ones will follow. We found that when the older children made right decisions in handling their other contacts, doing things around the home or responsive to us, the younger ones automatically copied. But if you make a mistake somewhere along the line and end up with unfortunate problems, you will be amazed to what extent this can. Doesn't always have to, but it can rub off on younger children that come along. I could go on and on with this, but I hope that you will reflect on some of the things Mr. Rice mentioned here, and I will close with bringing some of those thoughts out. It is perhaps good if you're a younger parent or a grand parent who has young grandchildren and can exercise example but not intrusion, that you pay attention to what is being said here, and you associate what I have said, what others may be saying on this or related subjects, with your experience or the experience of immediate friends in your family, your relatives, and that you apply what you learn, or at least instruct if you are older, and as you learn, you repeat the good things, but you don't repeat the mistakes, and you reflect on your own upbringing to see if indeed you are proving, which is so typically the case, to be an abuser of children, which is rare in the church, but it can happen, because you were abused. This is to me astounding, but it is a true fact. Most all young parents who abused their children grew up in a home where they wished it didn't happen to them, but they ran away from such responsibility, married young, have children too early, and are now as distressed with those children as their parents were with them. And they repeat the thing over and over again. It is very important that we reflect on our parents' upbringing of ourselves. Was the father a disciplinarian? Did he set an example? My father was not a strong disciplinarian. Perhaps this was not fundamental in his upbringing. He did discipline us, but I would say his strongest point was example. We tended to copy him. We never thought of doing anything else. I don't understand young people who grow up thinking to do something else, but maybe it is the environment in which I grew up. But he was the example. When it came to work, he set the pace, and we followed. You should reflect on the failure or the success of your parents. When you were growing up, what would you do the same? What would you differ? What did you lack? What did you need that you'd like to provide? Put those things together. Look in Scripture to see how it all fits. We can't leave the Bible out. But you see, I am not saying that the missing dimension was Bible instruction or discipline. I'm saying that much of the missing dimension was our example. So I am not giving here the one way to rear children. I am adding a dimension that was too often missing. Now in this matter, we should recognize that I have not dwelt on the question of money in terms of children having money to solve their problems. I told you that they can learn responsibility in money, and you can plan, and they should learn to set monies aside and know how to spend. And I think it doesn't hurt for them to spend too much sometimes and learn a lesson. The lesson is far more valuable than the few pennies or dollars. Or if they were careless and bought a bicycle and it ended up stolen, we need to teach them why it was stolen. Where did they put it? What should they have thought about in advance? In general, I can say that we've spent very little money on providing for our children. And even though in this work, Mr. Armstrong has seen that all of us have been blessed financially, I think this is an area in which I have learned long ago that the great blessings of a family do not come from quantities of money. They come from what you do with your person, and with your time, with your friends, with the children. What you provide for them that in many cases money cannot buy. It cannot buy your evaluation of their talents. It might open doors, but we've been very careful to let our children learn how to develop their talents in as simple and frugal a manner as possible. We've never denied them any musical instruments or art equipment, but we might go and shop to be sure that we were getting the best for a reasonable sum. We never gave them money merely to spend so their mind would be occupied. This is one of the great mistakes that parents have made. They have assumed that apart from the babysitter, the best solution to keep a child occupied is to shovel out a little money to go to the movie, to go somewhere, so you don't have to be responsible for their time. That's the thing not to do. Our son came home once expressing a lesson he learned. He had children, young people in school of his age who had to work for their clothes, and they were given spending money, but in a sense they had to earn it. And they had regular allowances besides. We've never given our children allowances. I never grew up that way, and I have never recommended it, and I never will from anything I know in the Bible. He was surprised because in reality, we as parents showed him it was our responsibility to provide for his needs, and whenever they had needs in school, we inquired, when do you need a new tennis, when do you need new tennis shoes? Usually they got ahead of us there because they wore them out in advance. But we tried to know what they did need in school to meet their class responsibility. We didn't expect them to work for it, but we expected when they worked that they used their money wisely or saved it. And they have earned quite a bit over the years in caring for other people. I think these are opportunities that children do learn, but parents need to know how little money it takes to create happiness and well-being in a home, and how much more it is important to save that money or invest it, albeit a small amount at a time, aiming at the future for their ultimate education in college, or providing the down payment of a home, which is very important in a place like Southern California. And if children know that parents have this long-range concern, they have the kind of respect for the parent that is important when it comes to their own future marriage and rearing of children.